Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Melinda Myers of Milwaukee. Lots of experience in horticulture. She's written over 20 gardening books, including Can't Miss Small Space Gardening, for example. Hosts the nationally syndicated Melinda's Garden Moment television segments and the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. And she's always a welcome guest on Garden Talk. With us by phone today. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Well, I'm doing just great. I went out and picked a bunch more tomatoes last night.
Oh, isn't this the best time of year? We work hard all summer, survive the heat and the mosquitoes, hopefully, without too many injuries and welts. And now we can reap some of the benefits.
Absolutely. How's your garden looking?
Good. You know, there's always room for improvement, and unfortunately, I have that disease that as I travel around and visit garden centers, I always have to bring some souvenirs home. So I'm on my way in from my last, I had to do a little TV this morning, and on my way in from the studio, and I'm walking in my yard going, I think I can squeeze that over here and this over here, and, you know, it's almost bulb time, so I need to find a few spaces for some new bulbs, of course. So things are going good. I think gardeners are finally excited about being back in the garden again. I've just met so many people that were worn out by the heat and the mosquitoes and now are like, okay, time to
get back in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I tell you what, Alan Westby is online and has a question for you, so why don't we go to Al? Hi, Al. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Good morning. A question. I wondered if it's smart, wise, to transplant pampas grass and cattails this time of year. I'd like to, with the pampas grass, because I haven't done it for 15 years, and looking at it, and you can, this time of year, you can see what those heads are like, and there's a variety of them.
Right, and a lot of people, just because people are wondering, can we grow pampas grass here? Those that have been to the south and southwest are used to seeing the big old plumes, but a lot of us call, there's two different grasses that are often called hardy pampas grass, and I'm guessing you may have the miscanthus. And that group of grasses are warm weather grasses, so they reach their peak with the warmer temperatures come into bloom. You will have the best result if you dig and divide it in the spring. Have I cheated the system? Oh, yeah. And I even have a friend that used a pickaxe one year to do his. Now, you know, he had some luck, but that's always taking a chance. So if you want the greater insurance, wait until spring. Same with the cattails. That old rule of thumb is if it blooms in the fall, divide in the spring. Blooms in the spring, divide in the fall. Blooms in the summer, either end. And I always say then the gardener's rule is you dig and divide when you have time.
So, yeah, absolutely.
So if you can wait, you'll have better luck. If you really need to get out there, you know, I would take out those seed heads, though, so you'll lose a little winter interest. And then do it, you know, as soon as you can. Make sure you water till the ground freezes just to help them get reestablished. Otherwise, wait until spring just as they're starting to emerge.
There you
okay,
go.
So what I need to do is also get permission from the people.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And cattails, there's some debate on cattails, and I really want to, there's one that's somewhat, there's people that feel that cattails, we shouldn't be spreading them around. And there's a little bit of debate on that. So just make sure that, one, you get permission. Two, you know where they are. And if you're doing the things that are growing in the ditches, that's Phragmites. And it looks kind of like a dust, feather duster top, kind of ratty looking. Those are really invasive.
Don't.
If that's what you're thinking of pampas grass, don't do that. So you'll thank me down the road. Don't do that.
Yes.
Okay,
sure.
Best of luck, whatever you just, once you get that permission.
Thanks, Al, for calling. On to Carol in La Crosse. Carol, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering how I should winter over a hibiscus tree.
Is it the tropical type of hibiscus?
I got it at a Walmart. I don't know if it's tropical or not.
Probably.
Okay, well, and I'm going to throw in both just in case anyone else is out there growing the hardy type. The tropical ones are the ones that usually start, they start selling them around Mother's Day early in the season, potted, smaller flowers, very wonderful. Mm-hmm. A couple things you can do. Bring it inside and grow it just like a house plant.
Okay,
in a good sunny window.
Okay.
If that's not possible, a room that's a little bit cooler, bright light, it's going to go somewhat dormant. It's You want to keep it alive, watered enough so the roots don't dry out, but not too much to get it growing too much.
Okay.
So you're trying to keep it somewhat dormant. Doing the houseplant thing is the most successful. It's going to have yellow leaves because of the change in light. It's going to drop a lot of leaves. You'll probably keep getting flowers through December, so that's an added plus. When you put it back outside, if you're doing any pruning, do it by the end of February.
Okay.
And when you put it back outside after a danger frost, make sure you do some fertilizing, a flowering houseplant fertilizer, starting when you start seeing new growth indoors, but for sure when you put it outside this next spring.
Okay.
The hardy hibiscus are the ones with the big flowers. They tend to bloom midsummer to the end of summer. They are hardy to zone 4 in general, though sometimes we do have a bad winter and lose them. After the ground freezes, if you're worried, you can add some evergreen boughs to the ground. The one thing you do want to do, I like to leave them stand for winter. It increases hardiness. And then they're really late to emerge in the summer. So I like to leave mine stand. Then late March when I'm cleaning up my garden and my landscape, then I cut it back to about 6 inches, 12 inches above the ground, mainly to mark the spot so I don't accidentally rip it out, because it takes a little while. It's one of those like butterfly weed that's a little late to emerge. Those are the hardy ones. Big, big blooms, started flowering maybe a month or so ago. And those are the hardy ones that can stay out. But it sounds like you probably have the tropical type.
I think I do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you'll have a house plant now to enjoy.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Barbara in Neillsville, we're on to you now. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is about my 5-year-old hydrangea that bloomed beautifully all last summer and this summer didn't produce a bud.
Is it? Do you know what kind of hydrangea it is?
It was grown in the north in Minnesota.
Okay. Is it got white flowers? Does it have...
It has blue.
It has blue. Okay. And it's 5 years old? And
yes.
And it blooms... Does it typically bloom for you?
Yes.
Except this year. Okay. Reason I'm asking is the hydrangeas that have pink flowers in alkaline soil, blue flowers in acid soil like yours, are typically... not hardy above ground. So if they die back to the ground in our harsh winter, they send up new growth, but that new growth doesn't produce bloom, just old wood. Now, I'm guessing you maybe have Endless Summer. Endless Summer was a new introduction out of Bailey's Nursery in Minnesota, and it came out about 5 years ago, and it was touted as the answer because it blooms not on only on old wood, but also new wood. And so even if it dies back to the ground, you'll get new growth, and it'll eventually flower for you. Now, typically what I'm finding with Endless Summer is those people that are having good luck, so you're one of them, so pat yourself on the back, typically are good at providing sufficient moisture, especially in the spring and then throughout the season, and a little bit of fertilizer, more so than we're used to doing with the white blooming type. So if you are good at watering, and most of us had pretty good rain this spring. Mine actually bloomed this year because of all the rain. But if you haven't fertilized, you might want to use, you know, like a low nitrogen so you don't promote excess growth, fertilizer. And the problem with phosphorus is we typically have high to excessive levels in the state. So doing something organic like a Milorganite that when the microorganisms work on that fertilizer, it releases the phosphorus in the soil that's already there. They've done research and found this to be the case, and that'll help promote bloom. Otherwise, looking at something low nitrogen that will do a little bit of bloom booster, that might help nudge it into flower. So next spring, before growth begins, you might want to just do a little bit of fertilizer, just enough to maybe nudge it, watch the watering, and it sounds like you've had good luck until this year, so just keep on that path. You should be okay.
There you
go. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, with your question, by the way, as we talk with Melinda Myers at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. And let's turn to Phil in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Phil, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about oak wilt.
Oh.
We had a tree that had died from oak wilt, and it's taken us over a year to cut it down. We finally did get it cut down. It was a joint tree, with another neighbor, so there was some dispute about it. But at any rate, we did cut it down, and I'm just wondering now if the wood is still infected at this point.
You know, great question. And this just brings up a... I'm going to just kind of broaden your question, so bear with
yeah.
me. And I know you know where I'm going, Larry.
Yeah.
With emerald ash borer and all the other diseases that are carried from sick trees to healthy trees, it's all, you, this is a great question. With oak wilt typically ripping off the bark, that dries it out, and that really eliminates the threat. Always, you know, with emerald ash borer, we don't want to transport any ash trees that have been removed. We don't want to transport them and carry that insect. Same with oak wilt. After a year, probably the bad news is that you've had some beetle infestation. You might still have some left. And then you'll want to tarp it also just as an added benefit. But if you rip the bark off, that's usually enough. Tarping it where you anchor it around the ground, that way if there are any beetles left in the wood, that keeps them contained and actually just kind of ends up cooking them out. And then the other thing to watch for is with oak wilt, the oak wilt disease is spread not only by insects that feed on infected trees, and then the fungus from the fungus pads under the bark, they carry that disease to healthy trees, but also by root grafts. So if you have other oaks in the area, you might want to keep an eye on those in case they were grafted to the sick tree, their roots joined together, because just keep an eye on them. You can treat preventatively or even with a small amount of infection, but you want to keep an eye on those. And you may even want to get a certified arborist out to take a look as well, just so that they can kind of look at the soundness of your other oak trees in the area so that you don't lose any more. So, yeah, if you treat it carefully, yes, you can take care of it. But you still want to treat it as if it could still be infected, even though it's been a year that the tree's been dead.
And it's probably a good idea. In most cases, I understand your circumstances, Phil, but... if the tree goes, typically if your elm or if your oak goes, you should get it out of there.
Yeah. No, good point, Larry. Thank you for bringing that up. I understand you couldn't do that, but Larry's got a great point. If you define the disease, the sooner you get it out there, the better, because it saves your nearby trees. You had a little extra things out of your control, but
right.
Hopefully others will not have quite those same challenges.
All right. Thank you
so much for the call.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Sherry, we go to you next. Sherry in Wausau. Hi, Sherry.
Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I have a whole bunch of irises. They're the mini purple irises.
Okay.
And they seem really prolific where I have them, but they don't bloom. And I'm wondering, is it because of the location or fertilization, or what could I do to make them less green, I guess, and more purple?
Okay, good question. Iris really, really do best in full sun, so especially the smaller ones. Siberian iris can take a little shade. Japanese iris can take a little shade and a little moisture, but most of your other bulb type or the rhizomaceous bearded type iris, whether they're short or tall, really do best in full sun. If they are overcrowded, you'll often get lots of leaves and no bloom. That can be an issue. Recently, I know this isn't you, but for others out there, if you recently divided, like if you divided last fall or late summer, they may not bloom the following spring. Fertilizer, minimal. If you have really good soil, you should be okay. Again, looking at something that's a low nitrogen just to kind of encourage growth but not discourage bloom. So if your soil's really good and you mulch with organic matter, I do minimal fertilizing with my plants and usually have pretty good luck with bloom, but I do a lot of time with amending the soil and using organic mulches. So it might be time to divide. It sounds like they're a pretty dense planting. And then if it's not as sunny as when you planted them there, it might be time to find a little sunnier location as well.
That's perfect. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks
a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Beth in Onalaska, we are moving to you. Hi, Beth.
Hi there. I have a question regarding peonies. My friend wants to pull her peonies out of her garden in Minnesota, and I'm wondering how long they could stay in a pot, if I need to put them in a temporary ground for the winter, or if they go in a pot over winter because I don't actually own a house yet, if I could transplant them again to a more permanent location in the spring.
great question, because I think a lot of us this time of year, people are thinning, dividing, digging, and they're offering these wonderful gifts, and we don't want to turn them down. So a couple things you can do. If you need to take them, fall is a great time to transplant, dig, and divide peonies. And so you could, and since you don't have a house, I would recommend potting them up just like a cheap old nursery pot. If somebody has a shrub, something, a shrub came in, or a big perennial, potting it up. You know, watering is needed. And then during the winter, you either need to sink that pot into a vacant area in the garden. So maybe you have a friend that, you know, their vegetable garden, you could just sink that pot in. That'll insulate the rhizome and the roots of the peony. An unheated garage would be your next best bet. And then the benefit there is then when you do get your house and you figure out where you want to plant it, you have a much longer, bigger window of planting time. You know, if it's not ready to plant until next fall, you've got that rooted peony that you can then transplant into its permanent location. If it's ready in the spring, you'll be ready to go versus temporarily planting it, digging it up, and moving it again. So yeah, I would pot it up, give it good care, and then get it, if you can, protect those roots by sinking it in a vacant garden somewhere over winter. That would be best, or an unheated garage. Heated garage, it's going to grow indoors too warm, so you want to keep it dormant.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Beth. Thanks very much for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest today as we talk with her about all things in the garden. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Melinda, how's that website of yours going?
It's going great. We just it's been a lot of fun. We're doing good. I started doing audio tips, like Melinda's Garden Tips, but for radio. So we broke into Canada, yay, and around the country. So we've been posting those. So we're just trying to find lots of ways to get info to people. So it's been good. We're using a little more social media. I'm starting to tweet, sort of, occasionally. And we have Facebook. You're so much better at it than I am. So we're trying to you know, help get people through the website and find what they're looking for in a variety of ways. So
perfect.
Going good. So thanks.
MelindaMyers.com, correct?
That, exactly.
Rick in Colfax has a question for you. Rick, hi.
Hello. Say, I'm wondering if you can help me settle a little bit of a debate between my wife and I.
Okay.
Oh, that's always bad news.
Yeah.
My question is it a good idea to use ashes out of the fireplace and or the charcoal grill in my vegetable garden?
I'm really glad you asked that question. Ashes tend to be very alkaline, okay, like wood ash from your fireplace tend to be very alkaline. And depending on the pH of your soil, you know, it can make it sweeter. It's like liming the soil. The other problem is it really doesn't do a lot to improve the tilth of your soil, so you're not adding organic matter that will help improve drainage in clay soils or increase water holding capacity in heavy, in gravelly, sandy soils. The other concern that I worry about, too, with the charcoal is just it's, you know, been developed for a different purpose, and I just am always nervous if they're doing something without the intention of it ending up in a garden. So
yeah.
I think your safest thing is, especially the charcoal grill ashes, not to use them. And if you want to use wood ash and you know where it's, you know, it's not treated, where it's from, that type of thing, you know, I would put it in a compost pile before I'd put it right in your garden, unless you really need to raise the pH.
Okay.
All right. Did you win or lose that argument?
Thanks, Larry. I wasn't going to ask.
I lost.
You know, I figured that.
Okay. That answers that question, doesn't it, Larry?
I kind of suspected that it was old Rick that wanted to put those ashes out there.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Mark in Mequon, we'll go to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about a 25-foot river birch that is growing adjacent to a brick walk. It's about 5 feet away. And one of the very large roots has grown underneath the walk and is now lifting up the bricks. And we were going to repair the walk because of some other areas also. And my question is, if I remove that root, will I be damaging the tree? Or should I move the walk or try to build the walk up over it?
And you said this was a 25-year-old burning bush?
No, the river birch.
Oh, river birch. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and
I'm not hearing well
it's
today.
It's 25 feet?
That's okay. It's about 25 feet tall, yes.
Okay, so now keep in mind I'm the certified arborist here, so I'm saying move the sidewalk.
Yeah.
And here's the reason. River birch like moist soils. They're a bottomland tree. The less stress having walks that reflect light and dealing with, you know, you're going to remove that root, but guess what? There'll be more of them coming. And so if you're fixing the walk anyway and you can make this work in your landscape, you know, for a longevity purpose, you know, if you can make it look good, I think you're going to be better off moving the walkway out whenever possible. You know, in municipal settings, I used to work for the city of Milwaukee, and we had a good inspectors and a good crew and a good relationship with the street and sidewalk folks when we had to replace sidewalks and had special equipment designed so we'd minimize damage to the roots. Most contractors don't have that because that's not their full-time gig. So anyway, you can work on minimizing damage as they replace the walk, that's better. And then by moving it out, you'll also reduce that. And then just mulching that area or putting ground covers around the tree will give it even a better home and help increase the longevity of your tree.
There you go. Thanks for calling, Mark. Appreciate it. Rick in South Range, on to you. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Thanks very much for the program.
Sure.
We imported a really nasty weed when we bought some compost a couple of years ago. And we've got something that looks like it's right straight out of the Jurassic. It's a horsetail-type plant.
Oh,
and,
no.
And it is infested everywhere we put that compost. And while I regret doing it, not much I can do about it now. Pulling it out, digging it out, and it keeps coming back. Do you have any alternate method of controlling or destroying this noxious thing?
If it is horsetail, and I always get nervous because I'm seeing people planting horsetail purposely in the garden, and I'm like, ooh, do you know what you're doing? It's a plant you'll see growing natively in wet areas, marshy areas, along rivers. It's beautiful where it belongs, but not in your garden. Like you said, now you've got to get rid of it. Continually pulling it is really the most eco-friendly thing. Roundup even isn't that successful on it, but sometimes if you've cut it and treat it, you may have a little bit better luck in repeated applications. I have not found anything that's really good and easy at knocking it out. That is, you know, and you're right, you can't take back the fact you put compost. Compost is a wonderful addition. Quality compost, it's sometimes hard to tell when you're getting good quality compost. So, you know, looking for a brand that's got a good backing that, you know, they can let you know that it's good and where it's coming from and screened and tested is even better. For those that haven't bought their compost yet. So I would say continually pulling it, and you may try Roundup or Finale and realizing you're going to have to do repeated. They're both total vegetation killers, so you want to make sure you get it on the horsetail and not anything else. And you're going to treat it, and it's going to look like it didn't do anything. And a few weeks later, try hitting it again, and it's going to take repeated application. So sometimes just continually pulling it. And eventually, if it's a drier situation than it prefers, that's also going to help slow it down a bit.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a question, an emailer, Debbie emailed in, wondering, kind of a true or false question. She wonders if the green ground cherries have a toxin in them similar to the toxin that you find in the green part of a potato.
Oh. Well, you can eat green tomatoes, though. And
oh, no, potato.
Right, but I mean...
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I'm sorry. So I'm logicking it. So this is not, you know, Melinda, I can't do a true false. not that I'm aware of, because you're eating a different part of it than the potato is the tuber. You're eating the fruit. We eat green tomatoes.
Right.
I don't know that would taste. And I've eaten green tomatillas are green, and you can eat those in salsas. So...
I don't know what they'd taste like, but...
Yeah, I would think, tomatillas are kind of interesting in and of themselves. Already. So as far as I know, no. So you might want to just double check, but that's a whole different part of the plant. So you're eating something different.
Let's turn to Dave in New Glarus next. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Good morning, and thanks very much for your program. Really appreciate your programs. My wife and I bought 4 new roses this spring and planted them, and the roses seem to be doing fine.
Excellent.
But something's eating on them. And I have been out there and during the daytime and at night and looked on the top of the leaf, the bottom of the leaf. I can't find anything except that the leaves keep getting eaten. And what this critter does is kind of begin to start like in the middle of the plant and then eat out to some of the major ribs in the plant, maybe eventually getting to the leaf until most of the plant's gone. And you know, and like I said, I can't find anything. I've sprayed with 7. I've sprayed with a rose insecticide.
Are they actually eating the stems?
They're eating the leaves, but not the stems.
A couple of things. It sounds almost like an animal. If I'm picturing what you're describing, if I'm picturing it correctly, when I see big chunks of things gone, I often think animals, deer, rabbits.
No, this starts as a small hole, and then it's like...
Oh, it does start as a small hole.
Yeah,
okay.
It starts as a small hole, and it gets expanded.
Okay, sorry. I was envisioning it incorrectly. If you had Japanese beetles, they're pretty much winding down. You would know it. They are pretty blatant. They mm-hmm. eat and mate in broad daylight. There are some caterpillars that will feed, and they'll start with holes. They're very good at lining up on the midrib of the leaves and hiding, sometimes going out at dusk. I know you said you've gone out and looked on the top and the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
7 would have taken care of it, so that should have taken care of it. But when we see big holes, it's typically beetles or caterpillars that are doing the damage. And beetles typically, you can see caterpillars often feed at dusk, and they really are good at hiding out.
Mm-hmm.
You may want to monitor, sometimes like pick an area now that you've sprayed, and see if it's getting worse. You know, I always find that I go, okay, I'm going to watch these couple of branches that are just starting to show damage, because you may have taken care of the problem.
Yeah, it seems to be slowing down now, but when I was spraying, it's like it didn't matter. And I thought, well, maybe it's like crickets or something, and so I tried spraying around in some places they might hide, and that didn't seem to do anything either.
Yeah, and the 7's pretty, you know, I always get nervous using 7 because of the bees and mm-hmm. worrying about hitting those. Good that it's just on the foliage. But that usually will take care of things, both beetle type and caterpillar type.
Okay.
I would just kind of monitor, mark your calendar for when you noticed it starting
uh-huh.
on next year's calendar. And this was advice Phil Pelletier gave me years ago. He always said, not that you start spraying, but you start watching for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times if you catch them early, it's easier to kill, you know, the insecticides, if you use that, are more effective when they're younger. I honestly, you know, you've done everything. I'd probably just kind of hold tight at this point, monitor, and then watch next year, and then call in when Phil Pelletier is on. How's that for passing the buck?
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot for calling. All right. Well, let's go to Rose in Menominee next. Hi, Rose.
Hi there. It's Menominee Falls.
Oh, well, sorry, Rose.
And I'm getting ready to bring my outside plants in, and I have a beautiful Mandevilla.
Oh, I love them.
And it's already getting some of the lower leaves are, you know, getting a little yellow.
Okay.
What do I need to do to winter it over?
You know, and this is words for everyone who's trying for the first time to overwinter a Mandevilla. If you kill it this winter, you're on your way to success.
Ah.
I killed my first one I overwintered, and here's what I find are keys to success. I like growing them as houseplants, knowing that, like the hibiscus, they'll drop some leaves. And I think the reason my first one died is it was not in an area that reminded me I need to water it. Okay? So if you've got a good sunny window, watered as needed, they'll take a little bit of dry soil. If you keep your house really hot, you'll water more often than if you keep it cool. And then just treat it like a houseplant. My daughter, who was never going to garden, hers grew and bloomed all winter long.
Nah.
And believe me, she called me all winter going, I have another flower in my Mandevilla. Oh, yours isn't doing well, is it? Oh, okay. So the other option is, if that isn't a possibility, I've also had good luck. I have a basement window. It's a little cooler, east-facing. I water less. I just water enough to keep it alive, and then in spring, bring it back. It's one of those acts of faith, though, because you just watch it and going, oh, my. That's not as successful as keeping it alive as a house plant, but you'll definitely have good luck. If you, and again, it's just finding the right spot that works in your house and for you to remember to water, but not overwater, and enough light to keep it going and keep it happy and healthy.
Okay, I have a beautiful sunny spot for it.
Oh,
hopefully if I water it enough, it'll regularly, or when it needs it, it'll do well.
And you know the other thing I like to do, and you may already be doing this, but for others, I like to get big saucers or trays, fill them with pebbles or marbles, set my plants on top of them, so when I water thoroughly, the excess collects in that saucer or tray, and then it evaporates and increases the humidity around the plant, and I don't have to empty the excess water, and the plants aren't sitting in the water in the saucer to avoid root rot. So it reduces our workload better for the plants, and it saves your furniture as well.
There you go.
Great. Thank you.
Good luck with that.
Thanks a lot for calling, Rose. Leanne in Heartland, on to you. Hi, Leanne.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Leanne.
I have, I had a little cedar growing in one of my flower beds, and I just recently noticed that it's gotten to be like 3 feet tall.
Wow.
And I really don't need that big of a tree in a flower bed, so I was wondering if I could dig it up now and plant it someplace else.
You could. I would do it soon and water it in well. Otherwise, I would wait until spring. It's one of those things where if you can move, transplant trees and shrubs in the spring before growth begins, that's your greatest chance of success. You're a good gardener, so you can probably push the limit. Fall is the next best time. And, you know, with deciduous plants, even right after they drop their leaves, same with evergreens, they're somewhat dormant. If you do it now, you'll also have some time to get those roots reestablished before it gets too cold. You may want to give it a little extra protection this winter just because it's gone through that transition. You know, it's one of those things that spring is best, fall is second best, and, you know, I've known gardeners that have moved things at the wrong time, and with proper care and a little luck,
yeah,
they do okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Melinda.
Thanks a lot, Leanne. You take care.
Thanks, Leanne. Dick in Waukesha, we're on to you now. Hi, Dick. Thank you for calling.
Question about purple loosestrife. What's the status? I haven't seen any this year.
Well, that's a good thing. We're happy to hear that.
Yes, I know.
It's still a problem in the area. They have been doing releases and with insects that will feed on the purple loosestrife. And I know the master gardeners have been working with DNR and nature centers and doing releases around the state. So that is a good, you know, that's a very good point. We really start to notice it now. It's really, you know, as things are kind of fading, that purple really stands out. So it's something we need to still be vigilant and watch for. But it sounds like, you know, I see a little bit here and there, but you're right. Now that you mention it, haven't seen as much as I usually do. So hopefully, you know, the insect releases are still happening. They're still breeding them and releasing them in problem areas to try to get it under control.
Are the beetles wintering over?
Yes.
That's good.
So, yeah.
Arnold Johnson had good luck out on Henrietta Lake last several years. So
no, that's really good, and they're just trying to get that population up. There are, every year we find more invasive plants, and since you brought that up, the DNR has a great website. If you go to their website and check out invasive plants, not only does it give you a list, it also has photos, and it also has recommendations for control.
Yeah.
So, you know,
it's a nice site.
Yeah, so it's a good place to go, and if you're concerned about others, or if there's other plants you're not sure about, that's a good place to go and check the status.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for bringing that up. Good topic.
Appreciate it, Dick. John in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning. I would like to know if Melinda's had any experience with repelling deer using Milorganite. I have problems with some small tamarack and balsam that I'm trying to propagate, and when they start going into rut, they just rub the living heck out of them. And has she had any experience with Milorganite?
Yeah, you know, it's not labeled as a deer repellent, but I legally can tell you that gardeners are reporting great success with Milorganite in terms of repelling deer. In fact, they're going to start doing some research in terms of other animals. They've worked with universities and it has shown, but to go through the EPA registration process would have cost millions of dollars, and they said we're not going to spend tax dollars there. Like any repellent, one of the things to keep in mind is that if the deer are hungry enough or need to, you know, run enough, you know, if there's enough of them, the populations are high, they'll eat anything, they'll damage anything in their way, no matter the repellent. Fencing is probably your best bet. You know, if you do Milorganite or something like a Bob-X, which is an all-natural product that has a little good staying power as well, you know, you might want to alternate it just to kind of confuse them. Or if you use any other commercial repellents, just always monitor to see that it's effective. If you're fencing, make sure the fences are intact. So, yes, I have had lots of good reports with Milorganite, though somebody said the roses in Connecticut can be protected. She goes, I went to Connecticut and worked even better because they're not used to Milorganite out on the East Coast. They are here in Wisconsin. I don't think that was true, but I thought it was pretty funny.
But they do get used to things, as just as you say.
Exactly. So change it up a bit is always a good idea.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah,
okay,
thanks.
Good luck. Let us know how that works for you.
Robin in Portage. On to you. Hi, Robin.
Good morning.
Morning.
Melinda, my question is, and I have two specific shrubs, can we still trim shrubs this time of the year? I have a northern privet hedge, and then I have a group of bridal wreath.
Okay. We'll start with the bridal wreath. Bridal wreath bloom on old wood. They have set their buds like lilacs, forsythia. All the spring flowering shrubs have set their bloom for next spring. So if you prune any time from now until they should bloom, you're going to be removing wood that's going to flower. So for me, bridal wreath spirea is really the main attraction is the bloom. So I would wait till after bloom to do your pruning.
Okay.
And then that way you'll get flowers the following spring. And you want to do it right after flowering or as soon after as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I avoid pruning shrubs at this time of the year because if we have a mild fall or a break in the weather, pruning not only removes growth but stimulates growth. And so I would wait until the plants are dormant for your privet. Privet, sometimes if we have a really, really extreme winter, we can lose them and they can die back. The winter of 95, so that's been a while, the last one that comes to mind. Leaving plants stand for the winter also gives you increased hardiness. And then doing it at the end of winter, late winter, early spring, before growth begins, good time to do your privet. But you could do it any time during the dormant season. We're not really growing them for the flowers and the fruit, so that's not an issue. So you could do it once they drop their leaves, any time until growth begins in spring.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
You can put that job off for just a little while longer.
Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, as we talk with Melinda Myers about all things in the garden here at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Email from Sandy from Wausau. She says, I have a fuchsia that I've overwintered for 3 years, does beautifully in the spring when I bring it up from the basement. It's in its original pot. I've just added soil to it. My question is, can I divide it next spring and make a couple of pots from it?
And what was the plant again? I'm sorry.
Fuchsia.
Oh, a fuchsia. With fuchsia, if you've got several plants in that container, sure. At this point, they're forming a nice woody base, and they're usually fairly single stem. But often in a container, you'll have three separate plants in one pot. And if that's the case, yes, you definitely can. I would do it right before you bring it out next spring, because then you'll have the whole summer for it to reroot and get readjusted and do well. So, yeah, if you're dividing the plants, one plant, cutting it down the middle isn't going to work too well.
No, it's not. Here's another email of Dave in Wausau. We want to move several sago palm house plants that have been outside all summer into the house before the frost. The issue is we always have had earwigs on the patio where the plants have been all summer. Any treatment in the house plants so we do not bring earwigs into our home, or is it better to forget the move?
You know, that's a great point. Earwigs were terrible this year. A couple things that you might want to do. A friend of mine once he'd take old nylon stockings and cover the pot and then, you know, set it inside the decorative pot so at least it slowed down the sow bugs and the pill bugs and the earwigs from getting into the soil. Slowed it down. I would try to isolate those plants if you have a porch or a patio or an area where you could keep them separate from your other plants for a couple reasons. Not only the earwigs, but also Also, any other kind of insects that might infect. Neem, N as in Nancy, E, M as in Mary, a combination of a repellent and an insecticide might, it's an eco-friendly way to treat that might help. And again, if you have that in-between area, you could treat the plant and it might help repel. When we start doing insecticides in the soil, it can be damaging, and often many of them smell bad. So when you water, it really just stinks.
Yeah.
Trapping, you know, creating a cool, dark, damp place. I had somebody tell me they took the tubes from the inside, the paper towel roll, put straws in the middle, set it around their plants. I mean, anything that would be creating that cool, dark, damp environment, the earwigs would crawl in. They capture them, then dump them into soapy water. So again, if you have a way to kind of transition indoors, so the earwigs, you know, aren't as close to your front door as they could be with the sago palm moving inside.
Melinda Myers, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Melinda Myers, our guest today on this edition of Garden Talk. Take a look at her website. It's melindamyers.com. She's got lots of great information on that website, and I hope you have a chance to look at it. Lots of good stuff there. Rick in Milwaukee has a question for you, Melinda, so let's go to Rick. Hi, Rick.
Hi. It's actually two questions on growing short or dwarf fruiting trees. In the case of dwarf apple trees, can you be pretty much certain when you purchase one that it will remain dwarf? And then I have one other question.
Okay. And I'm glad you brought up this question, because a lot of us are going to the nursery buying right now to do our fall planting. And when the plant says it's dwarf, it just means it's shorter than the standard species. So you want to check the tag and make sure it tells you how dwarf it's going to be, because the rootstock is what dwarfs the plant, but they have different effect on the tree. So a dwarf apple could just be a few feet shorter than those big old standard apple trees, or it could be as short as, 6 or 7 feet tall. So you want to check the tag, make sure you get it from a reliable source, because you may end up with something much bigger than you thought. And I just saw this coolest fruit trees that are really columnar, but they won't be out for another year or two. So I will keep you all informed, but I'm like, wow, they're narrow and upright for those small space gardens. If you can't go wide, you can go upward. So check the tag. So, and then also a reliable source, because, you know, things off, not purposely, can get mislabeled, but if you get them from a good source, and some garden centers are starting to carry fruit trees, but not the wider selection like some of the places where you can order through the mail tend to have a wider selection, or nurseries that tend to specialize in fruit trees are probably going to give you the best and widest selection.
There you go.
The other one is about a short mulberry tree. If I'm growing one that's already, if it's short to begin with, through judicious pruning, can I maintain its relatively short height but still have it fruit successfully?
Yeah, if it's a fruiting mulberry and you are determined and persistent, yes, you can. You're just going to, you know, it's like that whole bone's eye thing, mm-hmm. only on a larger scale. So, you know, gardeners, we are, we like to push the limits both for the plant and for us. So, yes, if you're willing to put the time in and the energy in and do the pruning, keeping in mind mulberries, once they start fruiting, the birds, you and the birds will have a good time enjoying them, and you'll probably have more mulberries that
right.
you can prune. But, yeah, as long as you're willing to put the time in and keep after it, yes, you can prune it, and, yes, you can still get fruit.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And somebody was wondering how to prepare knockout roses plants for winter.
You know, knockouts were bred by Bill Radler here in southeast Wisconsin, so it's kind of cool. It's a native. Leaving them stand for the winter, the less you do, the better. And the same goes with the less you do in terms of deadheading and pruning throughout the growing season. So, you know, you should not be fertilizing roses at this time of year, or really any of our plants at this time of year, because we're getting ready to have things go dormant. Some parts of the state, I know in the Green Bay area, will often get dieback to the ground, but they'll pop back up. those in the northern part of the state usually get decent snow cover, so that's good. And in the southern part of the state, I do nothing to my knockout, and I'd have one of the original plants. The other key is to be patient. I thought I'd lost mine 2 years ago, and I bought a double knockout that's even supposed to be hardier. I was getting ready to plant it, and lo and behold, my original plant leafed out, so now I have two knockouts in the So the less you do, the better. So if you're in southern Wisconsin, nothing. Central Wisconsin, if you feel the need to do something, wait till the ground freezes. Some evergreen boughs or, you know, a shovel full of soil over the crown of the plant wouldn't hurt, but usually not needed. Just be aware that it may die back to the ground, but it will come back. And in northern Wisconsin, you usually are fine because you have that consistently cold weather. So they're really bred for the do-nothing kind of gardener, so less is better in the case of knockout.
Okay. Here's Muriel from Lone Rock, Wisconsin, who has a miniature rose bush. She got May as a gift, blooming beautifully all summer. She'd like to eventually plant it permanently in her flower garden, wondering what the best way to do that would be. Of course, we don't know what kind it is.
Right. Well, one of the things, most of our miniatures are usually pretty hardy, though there's all those cool little miniatures that are sold at the grocery stores these days. And I buy them and put them in my windowsill and enjoy them for a couple months. You know, you may want to, if you've had it inside all this time, you may want to wait till next spring, enjoy it over winter if it's a small plant in a good sunny window. If it's been outside all season, you could do one of two things. You could move it into an unheated garage. I would set it in a box or a container filled with styrofoam packing peanuts on a board for a little added insulation from the concrete. Surround it with stuff to keep the roots insulated, or bury it in a very protected spot in your garden or landscape, sinking the pot in the ground to protect those roots. After the ground freezes, you could cover it with some evergreen boughs. Again, like you said, Larry, we're not sure what kind it is, so anything you can do to give it added insurance is better. Starting in the spring is also good because you've got that summer to get things rooted in and going before the harsh winter sets in.
Mark in Minocqua, it is your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Great, thanks.
Last year, or this spring, we bought three larger apple trees from a nursery, and I can't for the life of me remember what kind they were. We planted them on our deer hunting property, which is 100 and some acres. We planted them early enough, and everything was fine. The neighbor was kind enough to water them religiously for us most of the year. I went to July. Everything was good. The plants, all three trees looked really well. And I was surprised to see one little apple on one of the trees already. Well, I just went up there coming back right now from there, and two of the trees are still got leaves on it, but they're changing. The other tree, there's a great big apple on it, and all the leaves are gone, and it almost looks dead. I was wondering if you had any insight on that.
Yeah, typically when we put in apple trees, we like the first few years for them not to put out fruit, and typically, which kills every gardener to pick off any fruit that developed. That's not what killed it, though, leaving that one apple on there. There are a couple of things to keep in mind, and sometimes fruit when they aren't, or plants when they're under stress, will push out fruit, but usually more than one apple. There is a disease called fire blight, where the leaves kind of wilt and brown off and drop. They'll sometimes persist, but at this point they could have dropped off, but your branches usually curl. Look for canker, sunken, discolored areas. If the fruit's persisting and looking okay, it may be that that tree, for some reason, is a little more stressed than the other trees. So, you know, is the soil drained faster so they dried out quicker? Did the soil stay wet longer so maybe they're actually overwatered? Is the transplant shock harder on that tree for whatever reason, you know, just because of the variability? I wouldn't give up on it yet. As long as those branches are pliable, there's a good chance they'll leaf out. The heat this summer was pretty tough on plants.
Yeah.
Even if you watered well, it was pretty tough, and maybe for some reason that tree just couldn't deal with the stress as much as the other two, you know, maybe more exposed site. So I wouldn't give up on them. If your neighbor's willing to keep watering, if it's a dry fall, that's really important. A good soaking before the ground freezes is really important for all of our plants, but especially evergreens and new plantings.
All right. There you go. Thank
you. Okay. Good luck. I hope you see leaves on it next spring.
Thank you for calling. John in Menominee. On to you. Hi, John.
Hi there. My father turned me on to a trick for vegetable gardening, and what he's using is old tires, using them as like a raised planter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The theory is that the sun would heat up the dark rubber, and then you could plant earlier. But I'm wondering, do we have to worry about leaching or any other things like that with the chemicals?
Yeah,
I would. And here's, I started my career in the late 70s, and that was big when we were all doing, he may be, maybe I'm his age, and we're all doing, and we used to grow our potatoes in the tires because then you could pull them off and harvest them, and we do raised beds. But there are some products, you know, in the tire that you may need to be some concern about. They are shredding tires up and using them as mulch in the garden and landscape as well. I would just be concerned only from the standpoint of, you know, they're not intended for that use. You may want to talk to a tire manufacturer, and I'm trying to see if I've seen anything. I know talking to some people who've used the tire mulch, the fiberglass in the tire, one woman was telling me they'd use the tire mulch in their schoolyard, and the first year until the fiberglass particles kind of leached through, some of the kids were having allergic reactions.
Oh, my goodness. So that's the issue, John, or that's one of the issues. Thank you so much for calling. Melinda Myers, our guest today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my good friend and guest, Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, who is well known for her work in gardening. She's had 30 years of horticulture experience and 20 gardening books. She's got a great website called melindamyers.com. That's the place to go for that. I hope you'll join in with your gardening questions as we move along. And, you know, Melinda, before we go to Robin and Hayward with a question, at our WHAD stations, we had some problems with the station just as you were describing about pruning shrubs. Oh. And we've had several people call back and say, what was that? How did we do that?
Well, good. I'm glad you ask, because it's always a big question this time of year. So kind of just a quick review. So those who've heard it before, don't check out. Just hang in there with us. If plants bloom in the spring, forsythia, lilac, bridal wreath spirea, we want to wait to prune them after they flower if you want the blooms. If you don't care about the blooms, then late winter is a great time to prune them. But the reason we grow those are for the flowers. So those have set their flower buds already. So we need to not do pruning until after they bloom. Then right after they bloom, that's a great time to prune. Things that bloom in the summer bloom on new growth, okay, or things that we're not growing them for the flowers. And we can do that any time during the dormant season. We didn't mention evergreens, and I do want to take a moment to talk about evergreen shrubs. I like to wait until late winter to prune evergreen shrubs. The problem with pruning in the fall is we remove that outer layer that's really kind of tough and, you know, able to fend off, used to the drying winds and the sun. And if we take that tough outer layer off, we've exposed all those needles that were protected all summer long. Now we're entering our harsh growing season, winter, where the wind and the sun is very drying, the roots are frozen. So I really like to prune late winter. Also like to do that. So if I do have winter damage, I can take care of that as I shape and do my pruning that I feel is needed or want to do for those plants. So that's another one to kind of throw in the mix. Different ways of pruning online. Dr. Laura Jahl has a nice fact sheet on pruning. In my month-by-month book, I also, in the back of the latest edition, I cover different pruning strategies for trees and fruit and shrubs as well. So a couple of resources when you get out there with your pruner to kind of keep in mind to get you armed and ready to go.
Let us now go to Robin and Hayward. Robin, thank you so much for waiting.
Thank you. I'm actually at Lacouderie, which is in Hayward, Ojibwe Indian Reservation. But my question is that my husband and I, it's been a long-time dream to bring chestnuts back.
Oh, excellent.
And we're in Zone 3. And we got them. We found a wonderful place in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and they came, and they're beautiful. And we planted them. The mistake we made was we put them in the chicken coop, and the chickens went nuts over one, dug it up, and started eating the roots. And then we found out there was fish emulsion in some of the stuff. But unbelievably, we really thought it was going to die. It looked like it was half dead. They chewed off a third of its root system. And it came back alive when we left for vacation, came back, and all of them were kind of looking peaked, but we found out that was a natural process when they're reestablishing the roots. So anyway, I have been having trouble finding information on them extensively. I have an apple orchard, and I notice with the chestnut trees I have seen very few that it seems like they're the only tree. And so would this, how do chestnuts affect other trees? Would they kill off, or would we have to cut trees around them, or?
Okay. You know, I don't know that they have what's called allelopathic, which is what you're thinking, like the black walnuts and some other plants, which tend to keep the competition at bay. They do like good sunlight, so typically we see the chestnuts, though they will grow in groves. There's one, I think, left in Trempealeau County, a stand of chestnuts that some of the people from Department of Natural Resources and certified arborists have been working to help preserve and try to keep healthy and alive. So especially for you, if you can give them good bright sunlight, you're going to promote good growth, you'll promote good flowering, and then eventually nut development. Nut trees do take quite a few years before they start producing fruit, so patience is part of it. The other problem we found with chestnuts, our native chestnut, is often they will grow, but then when they're getting close to being to a mature age, that's where we often see the chestnut blight taking them out. So I think just giving them space to grow, keeping the grass competition down on young trees of any type is a good idea, mulching. I don't know if there's anything on the DNR website about the work that's been done. I know mainly from my involvement with the Wisconsin Arborist Association. There is a gentleman, and I don't know if he's out of Missouri. I just saw him. It's Chestnut Hill, I think is the name of the nursery. I think he has some information. There's also an organization that's the Midwest Fruit Producers, and I'm going to have to check on my contact list to see if I can find them. They're usually at the Chicago Flower Show, and they may have some people growing chestnuts. These are all avid gardeners, people like you that are trying different and unusual fruits or bringing some things back, and there might be a source of information there, too.
Well, these are hybrids, so we decided to go with the hybrids to try and avoid the, so they're American and Chinese hybrids.
Okay, great. Okay, I know Chicago Botan or Morton Arboretum is also doing some work with the hybrids. They're growing the hybrids as well. If you want to email me, info@melindamyers.com, and just be patient and maybe do a little nudge here and there. if I don't get back to you, I'm on the road pretty much through October, but I'll try to do some hunting and pull some resources out and get them to you. If you have access to the internet, that would be great.
I know there was some research on them, and I believe they have at least some limited at a limited basis, at least, they will lower germination rates of some types of seeds. So that's worth a look. I know the Ashland Bayfield County Ag Agent's Office, Jason Fishbach, is the Ashland Bayfield County Extension Agent. Jason knows quite a bit about that.
Great, thank you. See, that's why I love working with you, Larry.
Can I ask another question in there? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a Honeycrisp apple, and it has dark spots on it, but I also wanted to address the other man. I've never pinched off my blossoms, and I have bumper crops, but what I have found the key to apple trees, someone luckily told me mushroom compost, and that's what I always use. And I've had apples the first year I planted bare root trees. So, but anyway, I have this Honeycrisp that has these dark spots on it. And it was in cold storage. So my question is, could a cold storage be not recommended, or what do you think?
Well, they didn't go in with black spots, or did the fruit on the tree? So when did the black spots develop? After they were in storage? Is that what you're saying?
Well, when we bought the tree, it said it was cold storage. And then when it started bearing apples right from the beginning, It had these large black
spots.
Spots.
Okay.
Yeah, and it sounds more like apple. It possibly, are you familiar with apple scab? That would be my first thought.
Yeah.
Is more of the fungal disease, apple scab. Cold storage of the tree wouldn't impact the fruit that way.
Okay.
But we had great rains this year. So even plants that are resistant to disease sometimes can get the disease when we have perfect weather conditions. And it was a great year for apple scab. So my guess is it was more apple scab. And that was the problem. The cold storage of the trees wouldn't impact the fruit that way.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Great question. And soil amendment's always a good idea, whatever kind of compost you use. So thanks for the recommendation.
And do check in with Jason Fishbach in the Extension office for Ashland Bayfield County.
And I'm going to do the same. Thanks, Larry.
Let's go to Don in Forest. Hello, Don. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm in Claremont, Iowa.
Oh, okay. Excellent.
And I have some mango trees growing.
Okay.
How tall do they get?
How tall?
You're worrying about being able to get them through the door eventually?
Yeah, because, they're little.
Right. You're going to, you know what, if it will be a good problem if you have to. I mean, out in their natural setting, mango trees get fairly large, like an apple tree.
Uh-huh.
Again, that's one that you could, like the gentleman with the mulberry, with some regular pruning can keep it contained. Also, the fact you're growing it in a container, keeping it somewhat pot-bound will also help slow things down.
Yeah, I figured I had to put it in the wintertime. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I was nice, but not quite that warm and sunny in the winter. And that'll help. And the fact it's going in and out will help slow things down too. So I think you got quite a few years before you have to worry. And then as it's getting bigger, and you're like, oh no, what do I do? Just start the pruning process to keep it small.
You know, I had I lived in Trinidad for a year and taught at the University of the West Indies, and on my lawn I had a mango tree. It's probably 20 feet tall, and it was funny, when they came in season, the Julie mangoes, it was sort of like a zucchini. Everybody would bring their mangoes to work and try and foist them off onto somebody else. What a great problem to have.
I know, you're probably thinking, I wish I could have this problem back in Madison.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling, Don. Appreciate it. Lois in Appleton says, my rhubarb leaves also had what appeared to be round rust spots on them.
Yeah. Cercospora leaf spot is a common disease on rhubarb. Fortunately, we usually get a good harvest, and rhubarb's such a tough plant that even with a lot of abuse, it usually comes back. I would do a good cleanup this fall, so after the frost kills the top, cut the plant back and get that out of the garden, and that will reduce what overwinters and is available to infect the plants next year. I find sanitation is usually enough, if not a copper-containing fungicide, considered organic. A copper is one way to help reduce and prevent the problem. But if this is the first year, I would do sanitation, clean up this fall. If it recurs regularly and it's impacting your productivity, then I would try the spray.
And Susan in Menominee Falls, kind of another, well, we not kind of, another pruning question. She has an 8-foot-tall burning bush severely damaged in the wet snowstorm last winter. Many branches broke off. She pruned them close to the trunk and the main trunk, and remaining branches seem fine. However, the bush now looks kind of straggly. I'd like to prune it to allow light in and help fill out again. Any good references or suggestions for doing that?
The American Hort Society has a good pruning book in general. It's one of the best that it has, thousands of plant species, and it tells you when and how to prune, and some good diagrams in the front. Pruning is one of those things that I think you're going to just over the next, what I'd recommend is over the next couple of years, start trying to open it up gradually. If you do heavy-duty pruning, you also stimulate growth, and often long, leggy growth that then needs to be pruned. So I would try to gradually, you know, take a few branches back here and there, longer ones back to shorter ones. That might help bring everything back into the center so it doesn't look so top. I'm envisioning something. I don't know if it's what you've got, so top-heavy. And waiting. We, in the winter of 95, we lost a lot of burning bushes back to like a foot above ground. I wasn't sure what would happen. They recovered, but then they required a little pruning over the next few years to kind of shape them up and train them into that shape that you're looking for. So I would really let things start sprouting and then just do minimal pruning over the next couple of years to kind of create balance in the look you're going for.
Let's go to Scott in Wausau. Hello, Scott.
Hello. The reason I was calling is just getting some more detail related to oak wilt. My neighbor, I've relocated in the Wausau area out in a wooded section 3 years ago. I have cleared off part of the lot and kept some of the nice oaks that were established there. These are mature trees. I mean, 100-plus feet and beautiful canopies. But my neighbor recently told me that he had some dead oaks on his property and had succumbed to oak wilt. And the trees on these mature trees I have on our property have the odd branch or two that have some dieback in the middle of the branch but yet have healthy growth at the ends. Is that part of an oak's life, that it's the normal selective dieback that takes place, and it just requires pruning those back,
you know,
or is that a oak wilt issue?
Good question. Oak wilt is a bigger problem on red oaks, those with the pointed lobes, than the white oaks. White oaks can get them, but often what's called compartmentalize them and trap it so it doesn't, you know, kill the plant. Oak wilt typically starts as a flagging, a wilting at the top, and then it progresses. On red oaks, you know, if you don't do something, they're gone.
They're gone.
You know, white oaks occasionally, like I said, can kind of compartmentalize. They also have problems with a disease called anthracnose, and that's usually in the bottom part of the plant where there'll be large blotches, brown blotches that go across the veins, and that's a problem when we have wet springs, and it doesn't hurt the tree from a standpoint. It doesn't kill branches. You'll lose some leaves. Raking, getting rid of those is a good way to reduce the problem next year, and proper weather is usually all you need to do. So if you're seeing some dieback or a little bit of, you know, death here and there, it sounds like it could be squirrels. Sometimes they'll chew on branches for nesting materials, or twig girdlers that often those pieces will blow down or may dry up in the tree and drop, some kind of damage. If you've got, because it sounds like you have a lot of oaks, and because there's been problems nearby, I don't think you have oak wilt, but I think it would be worth getting a certified arborist to come out and take a look at it and do an inventory, because then they can take a look and see and go over any of those issues. I was just trying to flip through. I'm sitting in front of my computer. Extension has a good some good publications on diseases, including oak wilt. And I even find doing like a search, image search online through universities, that's a good way to get a visual to see, oh, yeah, that looks like oak wilt. I better do something, or no, this doesn't look like it, or yeah, it looks like anthracnose. Scorch was another problem we had. Again, oaks are pretty drought tolerant, but when we have flooding followed by drought followed by flooding, sometimes the root system can be compromised. The extreme in temperatures for many of us were an issue, so you might want to check that out too, just in case I'm not envisioning the right, what you're describing. It doesn't sound like oak wilt, but I would, because that usually wipes out the tree, but it might be worth having someone come out and take a look at it.
Yep.
Okay, yeah, and then just to add, I guess in the past on some of my other properties, I mean, I've had some mature oaks like that, and when I get, I had an arborist come out, and he said it's a good practice to, as these trees mature, some of that young suckling growth that you get on the lower, or the where the canopy starts, that it's good to trim those branches back to structure the tree right and let that tree grow up. So I've been doing that on these, which is really since I've opened up the yard, and I mean I've gained.
I hope you haven't been doing that with your oaks in the summer.
No.
Okay, and you know that, but we'll share that. That's a good point, Larry. Oak wilt, we really try to limit our pruning. I'm of the group that try to do it during the dormant season only.
Right. You're right.
You know, some that have stretched it a little bit. It's like tax day to the middle of the summer. But my view is, if you can do it all when they're dormant, you reduce the risk of oak wilt. You sound like you know that, but others may not. Less pruning is better. Structure is important. Wide crotch angles, which oaks have. We limb trees up because we need to get the mower under them or a car vehicles under them. research has shown, really, that the lower the limbs on the tree, the less likely it is to become a hazard. Pruning branches when they're small is always better, less wound. Keeping it open, avoiding branches that rub each other or, you know, anything that's growing straight up in the canopy. Another thing, getting rid of those because they'll eventually rub that main structure. So we want to be careful that we don't skin the trees, as I've heard
right.
you describe, by taking all the little branches off towards the center of the tree, but avoiding rubbing, crossing branches. And then, you know, if you are going to remove it, if you remove it when it's small, it's a lot less stressful. And as Larry pointed out, during the dormant season, to reduce your risk of oak wilt is really important on oak trees.
Thank you, Scott, for calling. And Katie in Menominee, Michigan, on to you. Hi, Katie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick question. I was very fortunate to find two very, very nice holly bushes, which I planted last year. They made it over the winter.
Hey.
I planted them fairly close to the house, not, you know, I mean,
right.
actually to the house. And I want to know how I can or if I can prune them to keep them the shape I want. They are probably going to grow to be fairly large size, which I'm not real, real anxious to have them do. They are showing berries again. They're wonderful to watch because the berries drop, and then they have a blossom that comes out, and then the blossom turns into little berries, and then they turn red. It's just fascinating, and they're a beautiful year-round foliage.
Oh.
So whatever you can tell me will help me.
That's excellent. Well, you should have the problem of them getting too big.
Yeah.
I love the optimism of we northern gardeners, you know. And, you know, you might just be the one where they outgrow that spot. What I like to do...
I'm going to turn you off because I can't hear you, but I'm going to turn you on the radio.
Okay,
great. Well, one of the things, and I'll kind of just make sure she gets to the radio in time, with holly plants, and you described it well, you get the flowers and then the fruit. So pruning, if you prune it, you're going to remove some of those flowers. So what I like to do with any of my plants, I like a more natural form, is control the size by taking whole branches out back to where they join another branch, or if you need to shorten them, do it selectively to kind of keep that shape you want, and do it proactively, so not waiting till it's overgrown and then trying to cut it back. But as it's putting on new growth and you've got a few more years under your belt and it looks like it's healthy and it's staying and it's strong and surviving the winter, you know, taking some of the longer branches back to shorter branches. So you'll remove a little bit of the flowering, but you're doing selective pruning, not shearing the whole plant. And by doing some selective pruning a little bit every year, you'll still have plenty of branches that are going to produce flowers and fruit. I would do it at the end of the winter again, so if you have some winter damage, but you know, you want to enjoy the evergreen foliage. You want to enjoy the berries over winter. And the flowers are nice, so that doing it in that spring time frame is going to give you your best results. Remembering you're going to reduce some flowers and fruit, but by selectively pruning, you can still contain the size, less stress on the plant, and still enjoy the ornamental value.
All right. There you have it. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Melinda, I know if people have questions they didn't get on today, you encourage them to call your 800 number, don't you? And
you bet. You can give me a call. I do a podcast, and we answer them online. In fact, that's where I'm headed right after this. And that 800 number is 877-743-6826, 877-743-6826. Also, in Ask Melinda, we've tried to capture 30 years of questions and answers, so that the answer might already be posted. Not that I don't like to talk to gardeners, but, you know, if it's 4 in the morning, that's usually when I'm looking for my answers. It's hopefully on the website to help you. And also on Facebook and Twitter. And so for those that are better at social media than me, I'm always looking for ideas and suggestions how I can help you through the mechanisms we have available.
And you do have Melinda's Garden Moments, Volumes 1 and 2 on DVD.
You bet.
And so that's something else. Melinda, always such a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
You bet, and I'm hoping I can get in studio one of these days to work directly with you and Jim.
That would be fun. Thanks, Melinda.
Thanks a lot.
Melinda Myers, 30 years of horticulture experience, brought to you here on the Ideas Network. She's just a great person, too. Great personality. She's got lots of enthusiasm for gardening, and I can promise we will have her back, and we'll do it again with her. Coming up Monday at 11, we'll take a look at your physical therapy issues with Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.